Abdullah Ibrahim is the South African composer who has had the greatest impact on jazz in the U.S. Ibrahim grew up in the port city of Cape Town. His grandmother founded the South African branch of the AME Church. His mother was a church pianist. In the early 60s, Ibrahim led a South African jazz band that featured Hugh Masekela on trumpet. Apartheid drove Ibrahim out of his country in the 60s. Duke Ellington helped Ibrahim establish himself in the States by producing his first American record. Ibrahim lives in Manhattan now with his wife, the singer Satima B. Benjamin, and their children. He has recorded with his septet, Akaya. He's led sessions with smaller groups and has recorded several solo piano albums. His new record, Minda, features his music from the film Chocolat. From it, this is African Market, featuring Ibrahim on piano. How did you first hear jazz?
Well, we could hardly afford to buy records. You know, it was so expensive. But in the community, of course, there were always enterprising young men, like they say, with no visible means of support, who gave us all the assistance, and they normally had access to records. So most of the music or records were heard from these people, and of course there was Voice of America.
It was when you were growing up, or when you were a young man, in Cape Town, that you got the nickname of Dollar Brand. You were born with the name Adolf Brand. Can you tell me the story of how you got the nickname?
One of our most potent sources of information of what was going on in the music world in the United States was from African-American seamen. And sometimes on board were, you know, there were musicians and sometimes just seamen who loved the music, and they had the latest record. So we would go down to the harbor, Cape Town Harbor, and meet these seamen and bring them home. So that's how I got the nickname at least, of Dollar, from hanging out with these African-American seamen.
Why the name Dollar, though?
Because of the American money. It's still a status symbol anywhere else in the world to possess some.
So did you like your name?
Not really, but there was nothing that I could do about it. You know, my family and friends, although I've taken Shahada and became Muslim and changed my name to Abdullah Ibrahim, they still refer to me as Dollar. But I think it sounds endearing. So we forgive.
You know, it's funny, when I'm looking for one of your records in a record store, you sometimes don't know whether it's going to be under Brand or Ibrahim.
Yes, well, we have this ongoing, problem with marketing people. And they, as much as we insist that we should only use Abdullah Ibrahim, they, in some cases, insist in using both names. And their explanation to it is that people do not know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that is not really the problem. You know, the name change was actually not a name change for the sake of name change, but when I accepted Islam, it was a change for a better life.
Mm-hmm. What was it that finally made you decide to leave South Africa? Was there a last straw or a breaking point?
There are vivid images and memories of our confrontation with apartheid and being subjected to its brutality. So one has decision to make. Either you stay there and toe the line, or you leave and try to carry on or play play the music, or you stop. We just stop and giving, like has happened to so many of our talented people.
What were some of the restrictions that were placed on you?
In terms of the system of apartheid?
Right, and in terms of where you could play or what you could play or how far you could travel.
Well, the system of apartheid sets horrendous boundaries on one's freedom, not just as a musician, but as a human being. We absolutely have no rights. When I was in high school, I was the first in my family to be able to go to high school, and then my great grandfather was medicine man. He was a herbalist. You see, he knew all the herbs from Southern Africa and taught us. He also spoke all the Southern African languages very fluently. In fact, all my family are involved in traditional healing, and of course, with the advent of the modern contemporary urban living, they were drawn into the church. So at an early age, I was exposed to that, and of course, the family wanted me to carry on that tradition and become a doctor. When I finished high school, I was refused entry into the, like many others, entry into the medical school. We were considered not human, not capable of pursuing this. So that was at a dead end. So in terms of the music, it was probably for me the only means of escape. Because at least we could play in our own environment. So I grew up in playing dance bands behind vocal groups, playing variety concerts. But the main halls or main arena of activity on a social, economic, and political From those aspects were completely denied to us.
After you left South Africa, you returned again in the mid-70s and recorded some sessions there that are being reissued now. And one of the pieces that has recently been reissued is your piece Cape Town Fringe. And I know that this was very popular in South Africa at the time of the Soweto Uprising. Can you tell me about writing and recording this piece?
Yes, it was after deep contemplation, being out all those years, that we decided to go back. But it was at the time when I took Shahada, when I became Muslim,
mm-hmm.
And the feeling was that I could still go back. Hopefully, well, they allowed me in, and that was on the way to making Hajj, going to Makkah for pilgrimage. And I needed to do it from home. And it was at that time that I got together this group of young musicians. And we recorded a lot of music. The song Cape Town Fringe was recorded in Cape Town. The original title is called Manenberg. Manenberg is a township on the outskirts of Cape Town, the counterpart of Soweto, perhaps. It was... when the album was released in this country, the marketing people decided to call it Cape Town Fringe, which I think was agreeable because the township or just the word Manenberg was completely, I think, foreign to people here.
Mm-hmm.
Like always, as always, in any struggle, and especially in Southern Africa, the music has played a very important role. We recorded this. We were in a studio in Cape Town, and this piece of music came in the studio. We were busy recording some other pieces, and we recorded it just once, one take, and left it. But we all felt so elated because We felt that we had captured the mood of the people at the time.
On the original recording of Mannenberg, recorded in the mid-70s, you're playing electric piano, which I don't think you play anymore.
No.
How does it sound to you listening back to it, the electric piano?
Sounds good.
Uh-huh.
But the reason for doing that was because we needed to take the music out to the people, I mean live. And sometimes it was problematic. To have an acoustic piano, let alone a grand piano. So we utilized the electric piano. That was really the only reason for you.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Have you been to South Africa since the Soweto uprising?
No, this was 1976 that we came out with my wife, our son, and daughter, and we haven't returned there because the regime refused to renew. To renew my passport, and of course they say that they do not. It's not necessary for them really to answer and give us a reason why. But since then we've become United States citizens.
Mm-hmm. Would you go back if the regime was toppled and apartheid ended?
Immediately.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of us feel that way.
Mm-hmm. Are your records available in South Africa now?
Yes, some of them have been banned. These were the more vocal, vocal ones, but the
vocal ones because there's words that you
exactly,
can take literally, right?
Exactly.
When you left South Africa, you met Duke Ellington, and he was very helpful for you. In fact, I think he was responsible for your first recording outside of South Africa.
Right.
I think your music still sounds very influenced by Ellington. Do you feel that way?
How can we escape Ellington?
Who would want to?
Exactly. Even if people want to deny it, there's no way. We do not just mean jazz musicians, but contemporary 20th century music. Any way and anywhere that it is played, how can you escape Ellington?
Holding a rehearsal with your musicians and you're teaching them or giving them a new piece of yours, how do they learn it? Do you give them music? Do you write it down for them? Do you sing it to them, play it for them? What do you do?
Well, the musicians have a saying when we say we're going to have rehearsals, and they say, where's the paper? Because I ask them to notate the basic skeleton of the piece first. So what I would do is, when there's a new piece, the piano is like command post. And I just come into the studio and start playing, even while they're busy setting up and talking about fried chicken they had, or where they visited the night before. And whoever hears it first will pick it up. And so the song is built around that person, the first one who picks it up and finds an interest.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So what do you mean it's built around them? Like the
okay.
they'll get the first solo or?
No, not the first solo, but perhaps the lead.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What a really nice interaction. I guess also it's kind of something of an incentive to make sure people pick up on it really quickly, because then they'll be more prominent.
Yeah, because the idea is really not to write notes and give it to people to play.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
It's the other way around, and that's why the so-called jazz music is so precious. It is so precious. It's perhaps the last bastion of human creativity.
You know, when you were playing jazz in South Africa, the music was very popular. And in America, jazz is much more marginalized right now. It's very little of it, sells a lot or is on the charts or has a really large following. Do you miss that sense of the music having this real kind of popular acceptance and of it having even a political implication that's picked up on by a lot of listeners?
No, it really doesn't bother us, because we understand what the problem is, and we are working towards solving it. See, basically the problem is that most of the playing is not community-based. Most of the playing is done in clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And so invariably the music that is written for the gig. Or written for the recording, session, whereas with us, the music is written specifically for a function within the community. That is what the difference is, and the music used to function. The music used to function here, in the community, but there is a strong and vital unfolding and initiation by people in this country. To take the music back into that arena, and it is possible.
Abdullah Ibrahim, I thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.